Hi, this is Marketplace Money for the weekend of September 25th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, this is Marketplace Money. Pretty much every weekend now, there's some one-year anniversary to mark in the financial crisis. This time around, we remember the biggest bank failure in U.S. history. 1 year ago, the feds closed down Washington Mutual and handed it to the FDIC, which turned around and sold it to J.P. Morgan Chase. It happened almost overnight and only added to the heightened sense of mistrust of the nation's banking system. And what have the banks done since then to make us all feel better? Well, they've raised interest rates on our credit cards, swiped away credit lines, and slapped all manner of sky-high fees on just about everything. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
So the banks haven't exactly been our BFFs over the past year. We gave them $700 billion. They gave us heartburn. But this week, at last, a limited change of heart from Bank of America, Chase, and Wells Fargo. Used to be that if you used a debit card and you went over your limit, instead of rejecting the charges, the banks would clear it and then slam you with giant fees that brought them about $38 billion a year. Of course, you should have been keeping closer track of your balances. But at least now you'll get a choice about whether you want that so-called protection. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Think of it as the end of the $40 latte. That's the latte you pay for with your debit card when you don't have enough money in your account to cover the charge. It goes through anyway, you get your fix, only to discover that $5 coffee cost $40. The bank basically loaned you $5 for the latte and charged you a $35 fee for that loan. It's called overdraft protection.
I was kind of shocked initially, and honestly, out of principle, I refused to pay it.
That's 31-year-old Jonah Golub. He had a bank account with Wachovia. The account had almost nothing in it, and Golub rarely used it. Wachovia fined Golub for inactivity. That pushed Golub's balance into negative territory. So Wachovia stepped in to cover the fee Golub owed them and then slapped him with $60 worth of overdraft fees.
It's amazing that they can get away with that. And they've been able to get away with it for this long.
Stories like Golub's have been getting lots of attention from lawmakers and consumer advocates, especially since most banks won't let consumers opt out of overdraft protection for debit cards, or at least they didn't until this week. Customers at Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo can now opt out. The banks also say they'll waive fees for customers who only go over by a few dollars.
It puts more control into the consumer's hands.
Carolyn Maloney is a Democratic congresswoman from New York. She says this is a solid first step, but more is needed.
This is good reforms. I'm thrilled that they're doing it. But what we need are consistent overdraft reforms for all Americans.
Maloney has introduced legislation that would require banks to get permission from customers in the store to give them overdraft protection. It could happen when you're swiping your card. Similar legislation in the Senate is expected to lower overdraft fees. But that won't eliminate them entirely, says Greg McBride, a financial analyst with Bankrate.com. McBride says if you choose to keep overdraft protection, there are still some simple ways to avoid that $40 latte.
Keep track of your transactions, particularly those small debit card transactions. Leave a buffer, a few hundred extra dollars in the checking account so that you're not running on a razor-thin margin. And then finally, some banks will allow you to sign up for an email or text alert if your balance gets below a certain level.
McBride also suggests setting up a link between your checking account and your savings account, or arrange for your bank to text you if your balance gets below a certain point. That's the kind of protection you can really use. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace Money.
Debit cards were created as a replacement for writing checks. Personally, I write about one check every 2 or 3 months at most these days. And I'm hardly alone. Just in the last 3 years, check use has dropped by almost half. Retailers took notice of that trend. This week, Whole Foods announced a pilot program where 3 of their stores will no longer take checks. Processing them is expensive and time-consuming. But some people use checks not just as a method of payment, but as a way to save money. Because the act of check writing can actually make you spend less. It's true. Jason Zweig is a personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal and an expert on the science behind our money decisions. Jason, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be with you, Tess.
I wonder if this is a generational thing at all. I remember going to the store with my mom and she would always pull out the checkbook, but I never do. And I wonder if that is reflected at all in how we spend, behaviorally.
Yeah, I think it is. I think you've really put your finger on it, Tess. It is a generational thing. You know, people probably 50 or 55 and older are a lot more accustomed to paying for things with checks because that's how they grew up paying for them.
Mm-hmm.
And younger people use credit cards. Credit cards are actually called money by younger people, and older people call them credit cards.
Big difference.
Yeah. It is a big difference.
Can you talk about what the connection is between how much we spend and how easy it is to pay for the things that we buy? What is the difference psychologically between plunking down a piece of plastic and actually having to sit there and write a check?
Yeah, well, let's talk about four things. Pain, pleasure, today, and tomorrow. When you pay with a credit card, you get the pleasure of consuming or purchasing the item, but you don't have to deal with the pain of paying for it until tomorrow, or for many people, never. And there's roughly 30 years of evidence to suggest that people will spend more money with plastic than they will with a check or with cash.
Does this sort of thing apply to something as simple in our daily living as the grocery store as well?
Well, you bet it does. There was a study done in 2003 of about 200 shoppers at a supermarket in Colorado, and it found that when people bought necessities, it didn't matter how they paid for them. They would spend the same amount of money whether they used a check, cash, or credit card. But when people splurged on stuff, it was a whole nother thing.
Huh.
People who paid with cash spent an average of $9. People who paid with a check spent an average of $11. And those who used credit cards spent almost $19.
Whoa!
Yeah, twice what the cash buyers spent.
Is there a way to change our thinking so that we think when we plunk down that plastic, we do think about it? Or are we hardwired to think about it in the way that you've described already?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the human brain prefers immediate gratification. What you can do is you can build in some extra steps. What you want to do is you want to take an automatic behavior
mm-hmm.
and turn it into a deliberate behavior. And you want to give yourself a chance to do a double take. You could put a post-it note on your credit card, on the back of it, maybe.
Ask yourself, do you really need this?
Yeah, that's not a bad little technique. The other thing you can do, of course, is you can take the time to make a shopping list before you ever go shopping. You could also experiment and just leave your credit card at home and bring your checkbook or cash. Another thing that some research suggests might work is go shopping with cash, but bring big bills with you.
Oh, I hate spending those.
Yeah. People tend to be more reluctant to break a large bill, and it may make you think twice about what you're buying. And then the final thing, don't go shopping when you're hungry.
I know that from personal experience.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Jason, always fun to talk to you and try to reach inside our brains to figure out why we do what we do with our money. Most appreciated. Thanks.
Thank you, Tess. A pleasure as always.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Remember a couple months back when vanilla was all the rage, as in plain vanilla financial products? It was part of the discussion around a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The Obama administration wanted banks and other financial institutions to be required to offer things like 30-year fixed mortgages and credit cards with clearly defined fees and penalties. Well, there's been a lot of horse trading since that announcement in June. And this week, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said the administration is willing to give up its demand for plain vanilla products. Our economics editor Chris Farrell has a little cayenne to sprinkle on that.
Doesn't it make you feel good? The bankers, mortgage brokers, and credit card issuers that peddled interest-only mortgages, option rate arms, liar loans are taking a stand on your behalf. Okay, I'm being sarcastic, but bankers have hired K Street lobbyists to block the administration's plan to require financial institutions to offer consumers simple, low-cost products. Their argument is that the rule, as well as the proposed Consumer Financial Product Agency, would cut back on the availability of credit and discourage innovation. Nonsense. The new requirement is that banks have to offer consumers the choice of simple products. That doesn't mean they can't sell as many liar loans and option arms as their hearts desire. So what's the problem with offering us simple products that are understandable and make for easy comparison shopping? You guessed it. Industry is opposed because the rule would lead to increased competition, smarter consumers, and by definition, more ephemeral profits. Why should bankers make life harder for themselves just to benefit consumers? The need is there. Have you looked at financial literacy surveys? It's a dismal, depressing state of affairs. We live in an age when individuals are being asked to take more financial responsibility, and yet the grasp of basic financial concepts is poor. For instance, about a third of Americans don't know that the finance charge on a credit card statement is what they pay for credit. Put it this way, just about every complex money product manufactured by the banking industry in recent decades has turned out to be bad for your financial health. Government support for free markets doesn't mean backing policies that largely favor industry and the rich. Adam Smith wisely warned against that some two centuries ago. Yet that's what the public policy of deregulation has degenerated into, a concern for profits rather than the welfare of consumers. It's time to save the banking system from the bankers. Treasury Secretary Geithner, don't compromise. Simplicity is a virtue in many aspects of life, including money.
Economics editor Chris Farrell, your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org. Unemployment checks are supposed to ease the pain of being laid off, but they don't cure it. So some find work on the side and under the table to make ends meet.
Morality is a very fluid part of one's life when they're economically vulnerable.
Plus, as the G20 meets in Pittsburgh, we hear how veteran steelworkers coped with their industry's collapse. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Do you know someone out of work? Based on the unemployment rate, there is a good chance you do. In some parts of the country, it's well over 10%. Millions of those who are out of work collect unemployment benefits. But if you ask them if it covers all their bills, you'll likely get an emphatic no. That's why some are getting a bit enterprising, looking for work that pays in cold, hard cash. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Michael used to test software for a living. He's 35 and lives in Seattle. Last year, a long-standing contract ended. He couldn't find a new job, but he qualified for unemployment.
I'm getting $272 a week, which is just bare bones. It's so bad that at one time I was going to the food bank. And, you know, when you're really hungry and when you're facing eviction, you've got to do something.
So he started looking for work on the side. He found it pretty quickly.
So right now I have Craigslist open. And what I've done is I've opened three different tabs. I've opened free stuff, all gigs, and all jobs.
He's found all sorts of work this way. Software testing, landscaping, bouncing, and lots of focus groups. All have paid cash. He says some weeks he's earned three times as much as his benefits check. Like everyone on unemployment, he's meant to report any earnings to his unemployment insurance office. Then they adjust his benefits down. So how does Michael answer the question, have you earned any money this week?
I opt to say, you know, no. I opt to say, no, I have not. Because this is my own hard work. This is my own ingenuity. This is my own genius. And I am still looking for work every day.
He doesn't see it as fraud. He He says the money keeps him fed, housed, and able to continue looking for full-time work. After rent, unemployment would leave him $47 a week for food and bills. Sudhir Venkatesh is a sociology professor at Columbia University. He studies the underground economy and the attitudes of those who work within it.
Morality is a very fluid part of one's life when they're economically vulnerable. We know this by studying the poor, that if it's a choice between being moral and putting food on your table to feed your children, you'll see that poor people are desperate and they do what they need to do to survive.
I spoke to Venkatesh at a Starbucks in Manhattan. He says a lot of people with unconventional work arrangements hang out in coffee shops, which makes them a great place to do research. He says all kinds of employers are prepared to pay people under the table.
I was in a cafe a little while ago where I met somebody who was working in a cafeteria for a major law firm. And she was laid off, and she was rehired as a cook, which she was doing before. And the way she was paid was that she was given money from petty cash. The law firm also allowed her to use an apartment that they had because she couldn't pay her rent.
He says many companies hit by the downturn need clean offices and security guards, but feel they can no longer afford the expense of an official workforce. So they lay off workers and rehire them off the books, paying less than what the workers earned before. He says about a third of the people he talks to in cafes are drawing unemployment and working for cash on the side.
What differentiates this economic climate from previous ones is that the people that are doing that may not return to a full-time job, and there may not be a prospect of a full-time job that's waiting them, because we're seeing that the quote-unquote economic recovery is not bringing job growth.
Hey, Alexander. How you doing, buddy? What's going on?
Across the country in Seattle, Michael's got a lot of time to play with his cat, Alexander. It's been almost a year, and Michael's unemployment is about to run out. He's applying for an extension.
I never thought that I would be on the edge like this. And a year is longer than I ever thought in this kind of like technological utopia that we live here in Seattle, that I'd be out of work.
Recruiters do call. Michael's had 10 interviews this year, but none of them have gone anywhere. He's thinking about signing up for a malaria study. It would pay $8,000, but he's not sure it's worth the risk of getting sick, even for that kind of money. He'll keep combing the internet for whatever work he can find, as long as it pays cash. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
It's pretty safe to say Uncle Sam does not appreciate the under-the-table work. So if you're looking for another option to supplement your income, there's always freelancing. No benefits, no security, but better than no income. If you're new to it, though, you got to be aware of the pitfalls and how you can protect yourself. Most importantly, how do you ensure you'll get paid? Tori Johnson is the founder and CEO of Women for Hire, and I asked her for some tips on how to talk coin with a freelance client.
You don't want to avoid talking about money because it will mean that you don't get paid. So if you are somebody who perhaps, you know, isn't comfortable wearing a business hat, you sort of just like to do your craft and kind of think about the money stuff later, that's not a good thing right now. You want to be somebody who's not only good at what you do, but someone who also recognizes that part of the responsibility or burden, depending on how you think of it, of being a freelancer is also needing to talk money and not shying away from that.
All right. Well, say you've gotten a job. What's the best way to make sure that you will be paid the right amount and on time?
The very first thing that I would suggest is agreeing up front. So before you start the project, before you begin anything, you say, great, I understand the parameters of this project. I'm eager to dive in. Let's agree about the payment schedule. And depending on the size of the project, so if a project is something that's going to take you a week for, you know, a relatively modest amount of money, well, obviously you're not going to have a payment plan built in. But if you're doing something that's a little more long term, it could even be several weeks or several months worth of work, then you want to agree on a payment plan based on milestones. And those milestones could be dates, so a passage of a time, or on deliverables, when you show at certain stages that you have completed the necessary steps by that point.
What if there is an issue with a payment? You haven't been paid, or it's not the amount that you agreed on. What do you do? Do you go up to the front door and say, hey, I want my money?
Start banging on the door. Yeah, I mean, so there's a few different things that you can do. So sometimes the thing that I hear from freelancers often is the person that they've been dealing with on a day-to-day basis tries to skirt the issue by saying, oh, you know, I submitted your invoice. I don't know, you know, what takes so long. It's not my department that handles this. And so if you feel like you're getting the runaround from your contact, try to remove yourself from that particular person. So, for example, let's say I did some work with you and clearly you're not the person who's going to write me the check. I might say, hey, can you let me know who the right person is that I need to talk to? Or if you want to even take the onus off of you further, can you tell me who that person is? Because my accountant wants to know. My accountant would like to touch base with that particular person. And the closer that you can get to the person who cuts the checks, typically the quicker you'll get paid.
And what if this just continues to drag on? I mean, at some point, do you get to a point where, I don't know, you go to small claims court?
For some people, sure. I mean, for a lot of people, depending on the amount of money that's involved, sometimes that doesn't pay. I had a situation like that in my own company once where we were doing some work and the person who we were dealing with sort of was giving us the runaround. Then ultimately that person left the company and we were sort of, how are we going to get paid here? And we wound up going to somebody who was much more senior to say, here's this work that we performed. Here's how much we were supposed to be paid. Here's what's happened in the interim. You know, help us get to the right person. And it was resolved within a week.
I would think that it would be very difficult for freelancers, particularly in this economy, to play any sort of hardball with an employer. I mean, you're just glad to have the work at a certain point, aren't you? And how do you know where that line is where you do have to start really going after someone for not paying you?
Sure. I mean, you really, really, really want the work because you want the money. And
yeah.
So it's not the actual work that's making you excited. It's the payment at the end of that that's making you excited, especially in this economy. And so if you know that you've continued to do work for somebody and there is constantly a problem with getting paid, you know, you have to think twice. That's sort of a moment for you to stop, pause, and look around and say, okay, well, how do I fix this situation? And you can be candid and say, from this moment forward, what can we do to make sure that I'm paid on time? And, you know, just like the phone company will cut you off for failure to pay, they'll maybe let you go a month or two, but at some point, someone's going to stop delivering a service until they get paid. And some of those same tactics can be applied in a very nice way to freelancers. If you see a pattern of constantly not paying you, it's your own fault if you continue to give somebody, in a sense, permission to not pay you by continuing to do the work and ignoring the fact that they're not paying.
Tori Johnson is the founder and CEO of Women for Hire. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The G20 conference descended on Pittsburgh this week. Lots of talk about free trade, financial regulation, global economic growth. That last topic would probably perk up the ears of the nearly 10% of Americans who are out of work, especially the ones with a front row seat in Pittsburgh. The decline of that city's steel industry left it with horrific unemployment levels. Marketplace's Rico Galliano spoke with two former steelworkers about what happened when their careers vanished.
We are the steelworkers.
We are the steelworkers.
Mighty, mighty steelworkers.
Mighty, mighty steelworkers.
I am Raymond Henderson. My age is 69, and I used to be a steelworker.
My name is Greg Mowry, and I was a former steelworker at Homestead Works in Pittsburgh, PA, for 23 years.
We are the steelworkers.
What was it like when the mills closed?
It was terribly sad. To come past and see the buildings just standing was worse than having them torn down.
I had buddies that committed suicide. Then there were other guys that just decided they were going to drink and do drugs. You know, I was a different breed, I guess. You know, it was just a process. I knew it was going to take place, and I knew I had to deal with it one way or the other.
I was actually on unemployment. I ran my unemployment and everything out, and I actually started working with my brother-in-law, construction. We were going, like, weeks at a time. We'd come home for a weekend every month, and my wife had to go to work. She never had worked up until that time.
Oh, yeah, my wife worked. That helped. And then after about a year, I decided I had to go out here and find a job somewhere. Well, they had a benefit through the steel industry and the federal government that would allow you to go back to school to re-educate yourself. And it was like a two-year program. I became a social worker.
I did actually go to auto mechanics, got a degree in that, but there was 100,000 people in this valley that lost their jobs at the same time, so it was very difficult to find any kind of work at all.
Oh, as a steel worker, I was making something like $50,000, $60,000 a year. When I got a new job, it went down to about $23,000, $24,000 a year.
I have a home in South Carolina, and I've been renting it by the year, so my tenants are basically paying my mortgage for me. It worked out well. Knock on wood, that's one of the good things that happened in my life. And I actually am receiving a pension from U.S. Steel of $500 a month.
I still get my pension, but it's nothing that I didn't earn. I earned that pension. And it's not a large amount neither, so, but it's just something that I earned, and I just figured if I live to be 70, I might get even with these guys. You know that they don't pay you until the end of the month, and they check the obituaries before they send you your paycheck.
Raymond Henderson and Greg Mowry speaking in Pittsburgh with Rico Galliano.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. By FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your money questions. And I'm here with our economics editor, Chris Farrell, once again. And Chris, we've got Julie on the phone in Hovland, Minnesota. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What's your question for us today?
I live in a house that's completely off the power grid. So doing the environmentally green thing to do from what I've been told. And there's about 100 of us in the county that are completely off the power grid. But the one thing we all have in common, none of us can get a conventional fixed rate mortgage. We're all on 5-year adjustable rate mortgages.
Did the bank explain to you why that is?
They said because we're not a conventional house, because we're off the power grid 100%, and most of us have some form of acreage. We've got 37 acres here, so we've been told those two reasons. It's not a credit thing. It's not an income, nothing else. It's just that we are not a conventional house, even though it seems to be the wave of the future.
So do you have power generation from, like, solar panels, or do you literally, when it gets dark, you're in the dark with candles?
Oh, no. I can actually – I've got DSL internet. I can watch movies if I want to. I can do anything that you can do in your house except iron. I didn't realize how much of a power draw irons have. But no, I've got solar panels, and then there's a small battery bank. Today's a cloudy day, so I'm not generating a lot of power.
Chris, does this surprise you at all that they're not able to get a regular mortgage just because they don't use electricity?
It doesn't surprise me because, you know, we'll put in quotes, you know, an unconventional home, an unconventional lifestyle. But the world is changing. And I think, Julie, the world may be going in your direction.
But wait, Chris, I still don't understand why a bank would care whether or not you use electricity or well water or, I mean, what difference does it make to them?
Typically, there have been a couple of issues that have surrounded homes that are off the grid. I mean, for example, it's been difficult to do appraisals. As Julie mentioned, there's a sort of a lot of homes, but they're kind of far apart from each other. And typically when banks are sending an appraiser out to look at the collateral, they kind of like homes in like a 5-mile radius, and they'll be looking at comparable homes and coming up with it. And then it's been very difficult if you're not connected to an electric utility or a utility company. It can be very difficult to get property hazard insurance. And there are some insurance issues that have also made them a little bit wary. But the good news is the world is changing.
So is Julie stuck then?
She may be stuck for a short period of time, but there's a couple things going on. One of which is that the FHA, Federal Housing Administration. They have been directed, and they are they have been creating, and they're going to be creating more, what are called eco-mortgages. And what this is it's geared toward people who are going to be making they're going to be more energy efficient, and it's mortgages directed toward them. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are also have been directed to move into this area. That's why I say I think you're on the – you may be early, but the world is moving in your direction.
But in the meantime, they're stuck with a five-year mortgage.
Well, I'm not 100% convinced that's true. For one thing, there has been a ruling made that they're supposed to, with properties like Julie's, they're supposed to look at a wider range. Now, you got 100 homes living off the grid. So really what it is getting the appraisers to do their job and look at the comparable homes and then do the values. So that can help. There's some mortgage companies that are specializing in this area. I don't know if you talked to like Green Mortgage Company, Julie.
Julie, have you heard of them?
I've never heard of them before.
Yeah, it's called Green Mortgage Company. And that's definitely a step that I would take. You might be able to get some additional information in Colorado and California. There are a number of brokers that have been specializing on off-the-grid financing. So that's why I'm not, Tess, that's why I'm not completely downbeat and here you're stuck on this, because I think the world is really moving in this direction.
So, Julie, it sounds like you're just going to have to do a little digging here to find folks who are a little more eco-friendly when it comes to your mortgage.
Yeah, because it's just been such a challenge and never expected it.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Julie. Good one.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Take care. And if you've got a question for us, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. Loan modification companies promise to save you from losing your home, but some of them will take your money and run.
The situation has really become kind of like a game of whack-a-mole, where a company will pop up, rip off a few people, close their doors temporarily, or even just change their name.
We'll look at the businesses that are cashing in on the foreclosure crisis. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. According to attorneys general across the country, the biggest and most dangerous mortgage scam going right now is loan modification. Roughly 1,000 firms popped up over the last year offering to help struggling homeowners. They'll claim to cut your interest rate, reduce their monthly payments in exchange for big fees paid up front. As Marketplace's Steve Henn reports in a joint investigation with Paul Keel of ProPublica, these firms change names, move, and reorganize themselves so quickly, it can be hard to know who you're dealing with.
Late last year, 21st Century Legal Services, a mortgage modification firm, made its pitch to Kathleen O'Brien. She and her husband live outside of Philadelphia, and the offer seemed heaven sent.
My husband is self-employed. As of October of last year, we were falling into the money pit, so to say. The income wasn't coming in as we needed, and we were trying to get a break.
O'Brien had called her bank and other lenders hoping to refinance her loan.
I hit a brick wall, and I couldn't get anywhere.
Then 21st Century found her. It proposed a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. It promised an interest rate of 4% or less. It said it would save the couple close to $500,000 over the life of their loan. But there was one catch. 21st Century wanted a big fee, now.
Basically, they told me, don't pay your mortgage. All they wanted was $4,500 over a three-month period. I was to write them a check for $1,500 and then post-date two more checks.
After the last check cleared, 21st Century stopped taking her calls. Then in April this year, she got the first foreclosure notice from her bank.
I was scared.
She was more than $9,000 behind on her mortgage, and her bank said 21st Century had not been in contact for months.
It was very difficult because I felt like I was losing everything that I worked for.
Even in the beginning, O'Brien had been skeptical.
I went on to the internet to check them out. They weren't listed with the Better Business Bureau or anything else, and I couldn't find any bad information on them. After I got the foreclosure letter, I went back and looked them up again, and they were rated F.
Allison Southwick at the Better Business Bureau says mortgage modification firms are popping up all over. 2 years ago,
there was a handful of companies producing hundreds of complaints.
Since then, there's been an explosion.
Now we're seeing hundreds and hundreds of companies producing a handful of complaints each. The situation has really become kind of like a game of whack-a-mole, where a company will pop up, rip off a few people, close their doors temporarily, or even just change their name.
Law enforcement and the Better Business Bureau have a hard time keeping up. Firms reorganize so quickly. Checking a name isn't enough. Tom McNamara was a receiver who helped the Federal Trade Commission shut down a firm called U.S. Foreclosure Relief.
It's a boiler room operation. It's no different than a lot of other boiler room operations that you see that operate either on the fringe or on the wrong side of the law.
The FTC says this firm operated under 8 different names in just 2 years. It spent $70,000 a week on advertising and collected more than $9.5 million in fees. When an employee insisted the sales force stop telling clients that the company could halt foreclosures, a sales manager emailed back. Here's an excerpt.
If we say we do not stop foreclosure, we're going to lose 75% of our business. If they implement this verbiage in customer service, excuse my language, but we're f***ed.
The company's lawyer said the firm's problems were caused by a couple errant, rogue salespeople who lied in emails and on calls. But after examining the firm's books, McNamara doesn't think it's possible to run a business like this both legally and profitably. And even after the FTC and local law enforcement shut down U.S. foreclosure relief, the company's employees didn't stop working the scam.
Just before we walked in, these guys were advertising heavily for more sales folks.
But the company's ads on Monster and Craigslist didn't mention its name. So after the FTC's early morning raid, after McNamara fired the firm's entire sales force,
that afternoon, I got the resumes from just about every one of those boiler room telemarketers, you know, and immediately they just, talk about whack-a-mole. Those folks just walked across the street, they sent out their resumes and started again.
Web entrepreneurs make it easy for anyone to launch their own loan modification business. There are online offers for loan mod kits that promise to provide, quote, literally everything you need to know about how to start your own loan mod business from scratch. So law enforcement officials have this simple piece of advice.
Advanced payment before services are rendered is not a smart idea.
California Attorney General Jerry Brown.
Don't give money up front. Go first to your bank or go to legal aid or some other reliable service. Don't take a stranger's word that he can help lower your loan.
Because by the time a company builds a bad reputation, there's very little to stop it from simply shutting down and starting up again under a new name. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
And late this week, the FBI raided the offices of 21st Century, the firm that promised to help Kathleen O'Brien. The agency declined comments, saying the move was part of an ongoing criminal investigation. For more, go to marketplace.org. Back with more Getting Personal, and I'm here with our economics editor, Chris Farrell, once again. And Chris, Jen is on the line in Riverside, California. Hi, Jen.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing well, and you?
Doing great.
All right, so how can we help you out then?
Well, I had recently gotten a letter from WaMu/Chase about my CD coming up for renewal next month. I had deposited it last fall when they were offering 5% interest.
Ooh.
Ah. Yes.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah, well, that was when there was the fear of the collapse. You know, they were offering these high interest so everyone would keep their money in the bank. But anyways, at this point, so when I got the letter, I started checking on what the interest rates were today and was really shocked to find out that they're hovering around 1%. I checked my money market account, and that's 0.75%. My checking account is 0.01%. So it just doesn't seem like the bank is the best option for investment right now.
Well, yeah, but Chris, the options would be then risky stocks if you want to take a risk and get a little more return. But boy, there's no safety there, is there?
No. So then the key question is, what do you want this money for? Is this money that you can put into the stock market, which my sort of rule of thumb is you don't put money in the stock market unless it can stay there for at least 5 years.
Right. I already put like 15% into my 401k, so I figure that that's covered. The only other option I'm looking at right now is the possibility of buying a house.
All right. So if it's money that could might go toward buying a house, you don't want to risk the principal. You'll take a low rate of interest. I mean, that's just the price for the safety. But I am a big fan of online savings accounts. And the reason is they typically do pay the best rate, and you get the FDIC insurance. And if rates do go up, you'll participate in that. They will raise the rate for you. If you lock yourself into a CD, you're going to just have to wait until the CD matures. So if it's something like buying a home, I would really take a look at some of the online savings accounts. There's some really good banks out there, and see what rate you could get. And then, I don't know, a couple of months from now, I can reevaluate the situation if I want, if I decide I'm not going to buy a home. But it's available for you if that's what you do choose to do.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks so much for the call, Jen.
Okay. Bye.
And next we have Una on the line from Chadron, Nebraska. Hi, Una.
Hi.
Well, welcome to the program. How can we help you today?
Well, I'm calling on behalf of my daughter, who bought a house about 4 years ago, kind of right in the middle or towards the end of when banks were handing out mortgages right and left. And it's been difficult to make the mortgage payments, but her lender will not refinance because, of course, her debt-to-income ratio is too high.
So has she already fallen behind on her mortgage?
She has not. Well, partly because I loaned her money, but also she, you know, has just been really struggling.
So, Chris, is this refinance worthy, or are we at a point where she needs to try to sell the house?
It sounds to me like she's really stretched, and probably home ownership is just too expensive. And so probably the best thing to do would be to get out of it. The market's turning around a little bit. It might be over the next year or two. Probably my goal would be over the next year or two getting it ready.
I know that she'd prefer not to sell. So I was just wondering if there were any programs out there that could help a person.
There are government programs that if the debt-to-income ratio is too high, they're supposed to renegotiate your loan. Now, the experience has been, is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? Because some people have had their mortgages refinanced, and others have found it impossible to do. I can't remember what the exact number, but it's something like 60% probably have had some success and 40% have been unable to get their mortgage refinanced. So you need to be persistent. But longer term, I would still raise the question about whether the home is too expensive.
So, Una, it sounds like maybe your daughter's first move should be to at least try to get through to one of these government programs and then also start thinking about selling.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate your help.
You bet. Thanks for the call. And that's all the time we have for questions on this week's show. You can leave a message at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. The way to do that is with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much, as always, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Chicago is important for a lot of reasons. The Cubs, poignant. Hot dogs with pickles and celery salt, brilliant. And WBEZ, a special shout out this week to the newest member of the Marketplace Money family.
My kind of town, Chicago is.
Oh, and one more piece of Chicago we'd like to make a nod to. The Second City Theater was founded in the 1950s. It's launched a staggering number of comedic careers, from Alan Arkin and Gilda Radner to Bill Murray and Tina Fey, to name a few. We wanted to hear stories of the comedy and, yes, tragedy of financial life as a performer. And so we are joined by Amanda Blake Davis, currently on stage in Second City's ETC show, and Brian Gallivan, a Second City veteran who recently made the leap to Hollywood. Amanda and Brian, welcome to our stage.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Maybe both of you could tell me what it means to be cast as a Second City player, what it's meant for you in terms of your career. Amanda, why don't I start with you?
It meant the world to me.
after college, I moved to Chicago to be a part of Second City. It was my dream to do it, so I really am living my dream. I just forgot to pick another dream because this isn't going to last forever.
Brian, what did you do before Second City?
I was a middle school teacher for five years.
Well, so that must have provided some fodder for a comedy show.
Yeah. Amanda can tell you, every show I did had some scene about learning disabilities or a parent conference. But it was my dream job. And any of the big celebrities who came back to visit while we were working there would tell you, like, this is the best time of your life.
Like who?
Like Dan Aykroyd or Bonnie Hunt. They'll say, like, this is so great. You get to do whatever you want here. You get to write your own material and perform it.
Well, you did make the choice to leave what was, particularly for show business, a stable job.
I think I just realized at a certain point I'd done everything I wanted to do. I was becoming the old man of the cast. You're kind of the big fish in Chicago, and you get a lot of opportunities and auditions,
right.
And you know you kind of have to start over in L.A.
And how's it been?
Tess, I don't need all this pressure from you about succeeding. I'm really trying.
It can't be all that bad, Brian, because I was at the movie theater last night watching you on the big screen.
Oh, what movie are you in?
I appear in The Informant. I give a Holly Hunter in the piano style performance where I don't speak at all.
But it's so clearly you.
With my physicality.
Amanda, how about you? As you watch fellow cast members decide that perhaps it's time to make another jump, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are I have my claws in so tight to that stage that they will have to pull me off. If I could stay forever, I think I would. But it's not necessarily lucrative. So while I do get benefits and I am able to pay my rent, it's certainly not a salary that you'd want to stay living on for the rest of your life. I think the biggest thing for me now, though, is to say if I want to go somewhere else with my career, I have to leave. I have to make that leap and I have to see if I can make it outside of this, you know, comfortable world I've created for myself in the last 10 years.
Yeah, but, you know, I do. I lived in Chicago for several years, and boy, I mean, the Second City cast, they were the stars. There must be something to that versus, Brian, I don't know, in L.A. I mean, unless you're Julia Roberts walking down the street, it's a little different.
And
isn't
I'm
it?
Not, Tess. I am
no,
not.
No, you're not. Your hair is shorter.
It is different.
I don't know that... That might be the perception from people who aren't on the stage. I don't ever, and you might speak to this too, Brian, I never feel like anybody recognizes me anywhere I go or knows
really?
Who I am. I mean, maybe across the street after the show, and if you're having a beer, somebody might be like, oh,
yeah.
Hi,
I'm Amanda. I was just in that show you were watching. You know where you need to go is downtown on Michigan Avenue. Whenever my parents visited, they were staying in a hotel there. Yeah. And actually, one time... My dad and I were walking. Some guy said, oh, Second City, hey. And my dad told my mom, and my mother said, I want to be with you when you get recognized. And so the next day, I saw a guy kind of glance at me and then start to look away. And I held his gaze, like staring at him
until
he
recognized me.
And he goes, hey, Second City.
Nice.
And my mother's like, thank you. That's what I wanted.
Did you pay this gentleman?
No.
Amanda, you're currently in a show there called Studs, Terkels, Not Working. Of course, after the famous Chicago writer and historian, there is a reason he's not working, of course. But tell us a little bit about the show. Any financial crisis bits here?
You know, we did a lot of financial crisis bits in the last show we opened. So this one is a lot more social issues rather than hitting the economic crisis, per se.
It's over, the economic crisis? Isn't it over?
That's what Uncle Ben tells us, yes.
It felt like the audiences were ready to laugh about something else other than be reminded about their financial crisis that they were in.
Fair enough. Well, guys, it's been fun. Appreciate you coming in. Amanda Blake Davis, joining us from WBEZ in Chicago, and Brian Galvin here in our studios in Los Angeles. I look forward to seeing both of you on stage.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you very much.
And to take us out today, a brief clip from Second City's take on last year's government bailout of the banks, with contestants bidding on the right price.
Contestant number three, our final bidder.
$700 billion.
$700 billion is correct. Washington Mutual, you are the next contestant on government bailout.
something that you all should know. Chicago is the greatest place I ever know. I'm gonna stay in this town. I'm gonna live in this town.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we hear about the lengths one family went to pay off $100,000 worth of credit card debt.
Nothing wrong with any kind of job, but it was kind of a humbling experience when you manage people and then you have to clean floors at night.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Sasha Woodruff. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Special thanks this week to our engineers here at Minnesota Public Radio. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. American Public Media.